I was just blind to it because I'm an American. I am utterly oblivious to the charms of soccer 99% of the time, but then every 4 years during the World Cup, I fall in love for the first time, again, an eternal sunshine of the footy-less mind. A few years ago, I was watching the games, marveling anew at the players' grace and athleticism. I'm an oaf. Their astonishing skills, I can hardly kick a can, and they're running. Wait a minute. Soccer has to be the most running-intensive sport there is. The widely accepted estimate is that elite midfielders can run a full 10 kilometers, or about 6 miles, during a match. So, one day in front of the TV, I asked myself, could a middle-aged man with no skills, no experience, and no real understanding of the game, but with a bouquet of marathon finishers' medals, hold his own on a soccer field? Or to put it another way, could my ability to run a few miles without vomiting actually finally have some positive use? I put out a tweet. It was answered by Emily White, a Chicago-area singer-songwriter and longtime soccer enthusiast. And a few emails later, I was a proud member of Team Orange in the Chicago Metropolitan Sports Association, an LGBT recreational sports league. Jonathan, the league organizer, said, "If you've never played before and have no knowledge of the game, then you will fit right in on that team." First lesson, soccer players can be catty. At least these soccer players. I bought myself some shin guards for $12, but figured old running shoes would suffice instead of cleats, especially since I had no idea if I would last past the first 5 minutes of the game. My one prior attempt at soccer, at an intra-dorm match in college, had lasted exactly 3 minutes until I stood wondering how I might get the ball away from an opponent, and he ran straight into me, knocking me out cold. On a Saturday morning by Lake Michigan, I put on my new Team Orange jersey, shook hands with my new teammates, including the catty Jonathan, carefully and repeatedly warned them of my utter ignorance, and took to the field. Rather, the pitch. See? Learning already. I was assigned to defense, which I assumed was the soccer equivalent of right field, where I spent most of my Little League baseball career. I was joined there by a pink-shirted opponent named Sean, who I was supposed to defend. Sean was about 6 inches taller than I was and at least 10 years younger, and chances were good he had played this game before. But I figured if he was posted out here with me, he must suck too, and how many marathons had he run, huh? I wondered if there would be a chance, given the rules of the game, to actually run circles around him. The game began. It didn't have the lightning pace or surgical passes of World Cup action, so as the first few minutes went by, I found myself standing around and idly watching the muddled action in the distance, again, much like Little League. But then a pink player kicked the ball downfield to Sean, who received it with a distressing amount of skill and took off down the field toward our goal. I gave chase. And I couldn't catch him. This was alarming. I honestly thought that I would be the best runner on either team. Did I mention my marathons? But this wasn't loping a long distance. This was mad sprinting, 50 feet at a time. And as much as I leaned forward and dug those old shoes into the turf, I couldn't outrun him. Another defender intercepted Sean, kicked the ball clear, and the action moved back to midfield. I gave Sean another look and realized, finally, that even if poorer players were relegated to defense, as I had been, he played for the other team. He was a forward, an attacker, the prestigious position reserved for the most skilled. And as I had just found out, the fastest players. This didn't look good. Orange and pink were evenly matched, and the action flowed back and forth. Pink was more aggressive and had some skilled midfielders, so the ball was often down at our end. The action for me was moments of repose interposed with more mad sprinting. I kicked the ball, once or twice, in the right direction, and even managed a header. I eventually began to think tactically. Depending on where the ball was, I could move forward a fair distance toward the pink goal, relying on my one skill to get me back in time if the action were reversed. Sean's skills completely overwhelmed me. As you'd expect, I never once managed to get the ball away from him. But, as I eventually realized, I didn't have to, and I didn't have to overtake him. If I could just keep pace with him as he ran down the field, keeping myself between him and the orange goal, he couldn't take a good shot. He had to either pass, and a better orange defender would intercept, or try a weak shot right into our excellent goalie's arms. I like to think that he started to get frustrated. Who was this short, bald guy who could hardly get a foot on the ball, but who just wouldn't get the hell out of the way? The whistle blew at 50 minutes with a score of 0-0. I never got to show anybody the goal celebration I had planned, which involved a backflip and some Western line dancing, But Team Pink didn't get to do any celebrations either, because in some tiny part, they couldn't get past me. My GPS watch, which I kept running between whistles, showed an elapsed 3 miles run, which seemed a fair distance on a 50-meter field. Most of that running was gentle jogging up and down the pitch, either following or anticipating the action, but there was a fair bit of mad dashing, usually in pursuit of Sean. I was tired, but not winded. I felt, appropriately enough, as if I had just run a fast 5K. To a great extent, my theory had proven true, at least in a recreational-level game, and at least on defense, i.e. not having to actually kick the ball toward a target, simply being able to run was a workable substitute for soccer competence. My new teammates congratulated me on a good showing in my first soccer game ever. "I like your hustle," shouted our goalie. I thanked him sincerely and said, "Hustle is all I got." I meant to keep up my soccer career, but of course I did not. My life is too complicated and my travel too constant to join a team and actually show up on a regular basis. And the last thing I needed was another group of people for me to disappoint. Back home from St. Louis, I rejoined my wife and daughters who had returned from Minnesota. As we waited for the Chicago weather to start to warm, the increasing tension in my house ground me down. One morning, soon after the Cupid's undie run, I got up in the dark from the attic room I had moved into, dressed as quietly as I could in a technical shirt, tights, a hat, and gloves, and sneaked down the stairway, doing my best to step in the front of the stair risers so as not to make a noise. There was enough disruption in the house without waking anybody up. I jogged down the street to meet my running group. I could see them, ahead of me, jumping up and down to keep warm while wearing their safety LED lights. They looked like a cloud of fireflies. And I would join them, and we would flit around the town and return to their homes where we had started, having gotten nowhere, and learned nothing. By this time, the glow from my fundraising win had long ago worn off, and I was dealing with familial and emotional issues that I had no clue how to handle, none of which were made any easier by cardiovascular fitness. As we started off that morning, I was gripped by the realization that all these years, I had been training for the wrong challenge. Maybe the time and effort I had put into running would have been better spent learning to be a better parent or husband or, given the increasing level of tension between myself and my wife and the seemingly unstoppable descent into open conflict, a more effective combatant. As it was, I felt useless, as if I had been practicing horsemanship for a decade and was now going into battle against tanks. Tanks with lasers. But then I was struck with a sudden memory. It was 3 years earlier, and I was with my middle daughter, the same one who was now urging me to move out of the house so that everybody would stop being so mad. I was walking her and her younger sister to school down the block, as I did most mornings. And we were late, as we were most mornings. Ahead of us, across the blacktop and playground, we could see the last straggling students entering the school, and the teacher's aide about to close the doors. We would be locked outside, forced to go around to the office to get another set of late passes. Unless... "Papa! Use your running powers!" she shouted. I crouched. I smiled. And then I flew. 4. As the weekend of the 2013 Boston Marathon approached, I found myself more and more grateful that I had agreed to run it. My domestic situation had deteriorated even further, and my home had turned into an unwilling host that was trying to eject me as if I were an infectious cell. I was less spoken to than spoken at. My absence was wished for so often and so vividly by my wife that the relief of giving in and leaving was greater than the satisfaction of defying her and staying. And by accepting an additional invitation, I got to leave a day early. Good job, me. The marathon was held on a Monday, as it always is, Patriots Day, the third Monday in April, but I headed to the airport on Saturday morning. My first stop was Hamilton, New York, where I was to give a presentation about the Constitution, based on the PBS special Constitution USA with Peter Sagal, that was to be broadcast just a month later. In Hamilton, on the afternoon before my speech, I had been asked by a local running group to host a 5K race, starting from the town common. And as I looked around at the group of runners, mostly college students, with mostly nifty expensive new shorts and singlets, most of them were adjusting headphones and picking out playlists before slipping their phones into their Velcro arm holsters. Most runners these days look like telephone operators in the 1950s. Their ears are stuffed with other people's conversations. I welcomed everybody to the race, made my usual jokes, made some stirring remarks about the running community, and then I started a sentence that I didn't exactly know how I was going to end. "Hey," I said, "I see a lot of you wearing headphones, and I'm going to make a suggestion. Take them out." They stared at me like I was a lunatic. In my long years of running long distances, I have also made great use of headphones and iPods. For races, I used to program special race day playlists, which would always begin with Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, a cliche, I know, and end with OK Go's Invincible, which I loved not only for its anthemic encouragement, "When they finally come to destroy the Earth, they'll have to go through you first," but also because of Damian Kulash's sly aside, "When they finally come, what'll you do to them? Gonna decimate them like you did to me?" Nothing inspires last-minute effort more than bitter irony. But after a while, I started to leave the headphones behind. First, I gave them up for races. It occurred to me that if I was going to train and practice and focus on achieving something, when the time came to actually do it, I could at the very least pay attention. A race, most especially and counterintuitively a marathon, requires more focus on the moment than someone who's never done it might imagine. We scan our bodies for discomfort. We check our pace. We count the miles and measure our remaining strength against the remaining distance. Besides, if you think of the great images of athletic achievement, Roger Bannister breaking the tape for the first 4-minute mile, Dick Fosbury winning gold with his newfangled Fosbury flop at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, Bobby Orr diving through the air as he won the Stanley Cup in 1970, catcher Jason Varitek picking up pitcher Keith Foulke after the Red Sox recorded the final out of the 2004 World Series, none of those people are, at that moment, listening to Squeeze's greatest hits. Then, as time went on, I started to give up my headphones for training runs as well. I typed all this, obviously, while staring at a screen. The computer was also playing music, which I enjoy as I write. When I finished writing, I got up and I went and I had some lunch. And, of course, during that I played music or news and probably looked at another screen, too. And then after lunch, maybe I raked some leaves or did other tasks with headphones firmly in my ears. I enjoyed music over dinner that day and then finished my day by watching another larger screen with some content that I hope commanded my entire attention. If I don't leave my headphones behind when I run, I wouldn't spend a single minute of my waking life free from input. I have a friend who wears headphones on long solo runs because he says, "I can't spend that much time alone in my head." I disagree. He can, and he should. Spending that much time inside one's head, along with the voices and the bats hanging from the various dendrites and neurons, is one of the best things about running, or at least one of the most therapeutic. Your brain is like a duvet cover. Every once in a while, it needs to be aired out. I am conflict-averse by disposition and funny by profession. And like the unpopular flavors of soda pop, my darker, angrier, and more earnest thoughts tend to accumulate in the dispenser and gum up the works. When I decide to run alone with nothing in my ears but the air and the occasional gnat, it gives me a chance to rehearse the things I'm too shy or self-conscious to actually say and to put them into words with the help of my constant left-right-left metronome. Often, my inner monologues are serious responses to the daily news my day job forces me to joke about, speeches that might be delivered from presidential podiums, or witness stands or news desks that the actual person in question just apparently isn't smart enough to give. They should consult me. In my inner cable news channel, my speechwriting always works and almost always inspires a standing ovation, groveling apology, or both. Sometimes, of course, these perorations are quite personal. In the declining years of my marriage, as our fights became more constant and more frustrating, my runs became the place where I could say the things I was either too weak or wisely cautious to say out loud. Condemnations and defenses that were never contradicted or interrupted, because I was saying them into the air. On my runs, unlike in real life, there are no rebuttals, no counter-arguments, no riposts beginning with, "Well, how about the time you?" In my running mind, and only there, my opponents are dumb with sheepish recognition. And every time I let off this toxic steam rising and evaporating with the other noxious gases from my sweaty self, I can feel the tension leave my arms and legs and my gait becomes looser and freer. I come from a long line of shoulder hunchers, and as I rant and run, I can feel my back straighten and my head rise. It's as if the dark thoughts I give silent voice to are quite literally holding me down, weights tied to my neck and clavicles. And as I indulge them, I cut them, and let myself rise again. And then, as my vents clear, I begin to think about running. Our sport seems mindless only to people who never run long enough for any thought to form other than, when can I stop running? But the only way to succeed as a long-distance runner is to do it mindfully, to be aware of the body and the world it is moving through. I think about my motion and my breathing, my muscles, and their state of agitation or stress or relaxation. I note my surroundings, the downward slope I would never notice driving the street, the hawk's nest I would never see for lack of looking up, the figure in a window caught in a solitary moment of their own. I think about the true meaning of distance, about the learning that comes from running a mile in your own shoes. I think about blisters and bliss and the voices quiet. So, in Hamilton, New York, on that April day, 2 days before the 2013 Boston Marathon, I looked out at the crowd and said, take off your headphones. A 5K is a little over 3 miles, and let's say you're on a 10-minute mile, so that's about half an hour. You can spend half an hour without distractions. Pay attention to what you're doing. Pay attention to your body. Pay attention to your breathing. Some of you are about to run your first race ever. Be here for it. Some of the runners took my advice, taking off their headphones and stowing them in their bags. I watched those people as we all shuffled to the line and started to watch for the first indication of someone spelunking into the darkest depths of their own head, their lips starting to move as their own inner monologues emerged to fill the sudden silence. That evening was one of the first times I had lectured on the Constitution, and I decided to tell a slightly different story than the one related in the PBS documentary that would be premiering at a Washington event the next week, 2 days after the Boston Marathon. Instead of the issues addressed in the documentary, federalism, the 14th Amendment, the Commerce Clause, etc., I wanted to address a basic question. Why did our Constitution work, with many exceptions for many people over the years, when so many other national constitutions have failed? The question had rattled around in my own mind since I'd shared a casual conversation with Yale professor Akhil Reed Amar, the featured expert in our documentary. He had said, you know, the Soviet Union had a Bill of Rights too. A Google search showed me that it had. It's a really good one, in fact. It guaranteed all citizens liberty and equal rights, as well as housing, a decent income, and even vacations for all. Man, that sounded like a great place. Obviously, the Soviet Bill of Rights was a meaningless joke. The more important and more difficult question was why ours wasn't a joke. Our film crew did man-in-the-street interviews all over the country, from the line of customers waiting to buy medicinal marijuana in Oakland to a Tea Party Express rally in Appleton, Wisconsin, and our conclusion was nobody knows anything about the Constitution of the United States. What does the Constitution mean to you? I would ask various people, and they would say freedom, a word that does not appear in the main text of the Constitution. And if I were to ask freedom to do what, they would respond, whatever I want, that's America. Sometimes they would argue that it gave them the right to carry guns wherever and whenever they liked, or to walk around naked if they wanted to do that, or to walk around naked with guns. Certainly, whatever the Constitution means, the people you don't like are obviously and clearly violating its spirit and have to be stopped. A lot of the people we met, like Steve DeAngelo, the cannabis activist who ran the clinic in Oakland, believed the Constitution affords states, like California, the right to do whatever they please, like legalize cannabis. Others, like Chris Perry and Sandy Steer, from geographically and philosophically nearby Berkeley, believe the Constitution prevents states, like California, from doing what the population of the state wants it to do, like banning marriages between same-sex partners, as California did in the state election of 2008. Chris and her partner Sandy were co-plaintiffs, along with Paul Katami and Jeff Zerillo, in the successful federal lawsuit against Proposition 8. There are people like Gary Marbut, a gun rights activist in Montana, who believes the federal government violates the Constitution by not protecting his right to sell his firearms to anyone he likes whenever he likes. And there are other people like Minnie Jean Brown Trickey, one of the Little Rock Nine, who feels the federal government violated the Constitution by not protecting her civil right to attend a desegregated high school, even though it once sent in the 101st Airborne Division to do just that. So, given all this sometimes vitriolic disagreement as to what the document means, I asked the audience in Hamilton, why does the Constitution continue to function? Because even if the citizens of this country don't know much about the Constitution, its language, its history, the complexities of constitutional law as established by 2 centuries of Supreme Court jurisprudence, they believe in it. Almost everyone in America, from peon to president, believes that we are ruled by laws, that everybody must subject themselves to a duly constituted government, and that we will settle disputes by peaceful, if sometimes rhetorically vicious, means. We all believe the solution to an election that doesn't go your way is the next election, not violent rebellion. We believe that the way to solve even the most bitter dispute with a neighbor is through the courts, not by firebombing their house. If the principles of the Constitution are violated, the document itself does not flap its parchment wings and fly out of the National Archives to beat the reprobate about the head and shoulders until he relents and confesses his error. He is restrained, if he can be restrained, by a collective belief, a civic religion, an irrational faith in the power of democratic rule. Nixon, I pointed out, knew that if he handed over the Watergate tapes after the Supreme Court ruled against him in 1974, his presidency would be over. But if he didn't do what the court ordered, if he simply refused, what would have occurred? He was the one who had the army. But even Nixon knew what he had to do when the final choice had to be made. He knew that to do otherwise would instantly change his place in history from disgraced president to quite possibly the last president, the man who ended the American experiment. Thus, I said to the happy people of Hamilton, the Constitution was and remains a communal agreement, an imaginary construct given weight and meaning by collective belief. It is the Tinkerbell of national charters. It only stays alive by our constant and enthusiastic clapping. If enough of us stop believing in it, if we reach some tipping point, unknowable until we reach it, when enough people cease to honor it or any of its provisions, then it will fade away, like the picture of Marty McFly and his siblings in Back to the Future. Everybody laughed and clapped and nodded. I've given that lecture many times since then, and it has occurred to me that there are a lot of other things that we take for granted as reality, as agreements and understandings that can't be broken. And then they are. And we are left gaping at the new paradigm like someone returning home to a house consumed by fire. How can something disappear so quickly and so completely? A home, a marriage, a family. How could, what is, it was just here. We live in a world of mutually assured hallucination. That which we imagine to be immutable is not. Those which we think of as laws are, to paraphrase Pirates of the Caribbean, merely suggestions. And if enough people decide to believe something else, then that other reality supplants our own. There were times, many of them, during the course of my first divorced year, when I would say to myself, things will have to get back to normal, not realizing that reality is democratically determined and I only have one vote. 3 years later, in 2016, this principle would be proved on a national level, although that, too, was something I then didn't have the capacity to imagine. People enjoyed my presentation. I was taken out for a drink by my host, then I went to bed in my hotel, and in the morning I got up and flew to Newark to connect to Boston. Sitting in the Newark airport, waiting for my connecting flight, I realized that it had been, as far as I could remember, exactly 40 years since my first airplane flight, when as a young master sagal of 8 years, I had flown the same route from Newark to Boston to visit my grandmother. I remembered getting a cool metal pilot wings pin to put on my blazer, which I wore over my turtleneck sweater. As I got on the airplane, which I hoped was a different one than I had ridden 40 years before, I told the flight attendant the story, and I asked her if they still had wings for traveling minors. She laughed and nodded and handed over what passes for souvenir airline pilot wings these days, a cheap-ass bit of plastic. Things really did seem to be on a downward slope. I pinned it to my shirt nonetheless, posted a selfie to Twitter, and settled in for the flight to Boston and the marathon. I was nervous. Marathons are hard, and I hadn't been adequately training for this one. A man named William Greer, who I had never met, was going to be depending on me, and he might prove to be foolish to have done so. I honestly didn't know what would happen. It was the loudest noise I have ever heard, an enormous, percussive, deeply metallic bang! And it was close, close enough to feel as well as hear, about 100 yards away, judging from the rising plume of smoke. Our view of the spot was blocked by the superstructure of the finish line, the camera towers, and the armature of ceremony. We couldn't see what was happening. Then there was a second bang! Farther away, another plume of smoke. I like to believe now that at that moment, in that place, as the smoke dissipated into the sky, I considered walking toward the source of the sound to see what had happened. I'm a curious human being, and though not a journalist, I work for a prestigious journalistic organization. And a very unusual and alarming thing had happened. A braver man might have at least tried to get a closer look. Instead, I just stood there, and a woman said to me, "What do you think it was?" And I said, "I don't know, maybe a power transformer?" The woman, "Maybe a car backfired?" "Too loud for that. You think it's a bomb?" "No way," I said. "I mean, seriously, a bomb?" I met that woman again 2 years later, at a function for Team with a Vision. She introduced herself to me as the woman who was standing next to you when the bomb went off. I quizzed her carefully as to how far away she thought we were. As I have told the story over the years, I have become anxious about the possibility of overstating our nearness to the bombing. I feel like I owe it to the people who are unlucky enough to be closer to not claim their proximity. Anyway, she agreed with me about 100 yards. Like me, she had returned to the spot where we were standing and tried to measure it. The shoot volunteers encouraged us to get moving away from the finish. William, completely exhausted, his adrenaline draining from his system, was feeling every mile he had just run, and he slowly walked along as best he could. He told me later that he was as alarmed as the rest of us, but as the enormity of whatever had happened became clearer around us, he mainly started to worry about Ellen, his wife. Where was she? Had she taken advantage of the lateness of the day? The winners and elites had long since finished and were probably showered and dressed by now. To find a premium spot to watch, right by the finish line, right where the plumes of smoke were? We heard sirens. One, two, then a lot. The finishing chute volunteers around us looked worried too, although they were as ignorant as we were. The volunteer coordinators, though, the ones sitting in the high lifeguard chairs to spot runners in trouble or other crises, looked scared. They had radio earpieces. They all waved their arms, shouting, "Keep moving!" We shuffled through the finish chute, just like you always do at the end of a normal race, so we acted like it was one. Smiling young students looped finishers' medals around our necks. We picked up some bottles of water and Gatorade. We heard more sirens. We might have noticed, if we had turned around, that the flow of runners across the line behind us had stopped. We were the last ones on that day and in that place to do anything normal. In the city, state, and country around us, tweets and texts and news alerts were flashing across everybody's phones, screens, and TVs. The runners on the course miles back were being told they couldn't finish the race, but not why. Still in the chute, we had no phones, and nobody told us anything, so we continued shuffling along and picked up a granola bar or four. "William," I said as the world around us convulsed in shock and horror, "you want a banana?" The first moment I knew for certain that something was terribly wrong was when we stepped out of the chute onto Exeter Street, and an enormous Boston street cop with a red face and mustache, straight out of a George V. Higgins novel, went sprinting down the street toward the finish line, shouting, "Clear the street! Clear the street!" He was followed by an ambulance flashing everything red. "Wow," I said to myself. What would make that cop run that fast? We exited the finishers' area and made our way to the appointed meeting place to find a very worried Josh Warren. "They've stopped the race," he said, telling us the police were holding all the runners still on the course a mile behind the finish line, which meant, for Josh, that he had up to 20 people scattered along 10 miles of pavement, and he had no way of reaching them because he was holding all of their phones in a plastic bag. And, by the way, half of those people were legally blind. We retrieved our phones from Josh and, like everybody else on the planet, tried to figure out what had just happened. Unlike everybody else, we were able to smell it. The air had an acrid tinge, like something had been burned on a pyre. The first thing I saw were texts from friends who knew I was there. "Are you all right?" Twitter said there was an explosion at the Boston Marathon. Nobody knew what it was. I could not believe it was terrorists. It just seemed so unlikely, the kind of thing my mother would worry about, and I would say, "Mom, don't be ridiculous." A woman nearby downloaded a picture of the explosion site. She showed it to me. The sidewalk was covered with a sticky-looking red slick. "Maybe it's Gatorade," I said, far up the Denial River. William was trying to reach Ellen, who was not at the meeting place. The cell towers apparently were overloaded, so I was surprised when my phone rang with a DC area code showing on the screen. "Peter, this is Julia from All Things Considered. We understand you ran the Boston Marathon today." I told her I had and was now standing a few blocks from the finish line. "Great, yes, apparently there's been a bombing. Could you go on the air and talk to Robert Siegel about it?" I walked around the corner and back toward the finishing chute while they hooked up a phone line to Robert Siegel in the Washington studio. In the 15 minutes since we had walked out of it, the finishing chute had been entirely dismantled. Every table and piled crate of bottled water, every banana box, every awning and medical station, gone. The movable fencing that had delineated the chute was still there, though it had all been rearranged to form a perimeter about 3 blocks east of the finish line. Robert got on the line. I've known Robert for years, of course, and he's always convivial and joking. Not this time. Hello, Peter. I understand you're at the finish line. I'm told yes, we're about to go live. Thank you. Robert has the ability to remain preternaturally calm no matter the circumstances. If we're lucky, we'll have him narrate the apocalypse. Here is my one and only contribution to NPR's breaking news coverage.
Peter Sagal, the host of the NPR News Quiz program, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, ran in the Boston Marathon today, and he joins us now. Peter, how close were you to the explosions?
Robert, I was about 100 yards beyond the point of the explosion in what we call the finishing chute, a long area that runners walk through after finishing a marathon. We had just finished at about, I think it was 2:45 around there, Boston time. Heard a huge explosion. I had been guiding a blind runner today, so both he and I were shocked. I turned around and saw a big white plume of smoke that appeared on the other side of the finishing line from us, that is, in the course side. Then another second large explosion happened just a moment later with another plume of smoke.
And did the second explosion come from the same side as the first?
It seemed to. It seemed to come in the same place from my perspective. At that point, the officials in the marathon asked all of us in the chute to keep moving forward away from it. I've now returned, it's I guess 20 minutes, half hour later, to Boylston Street. The chute is completely closed. They're moving people off Boylston Street, and there are no people finishing the race. They seem to have stopped the race. There were many people behind us.
Yeah.
Normally, there'd be people flowing through this area by the hundreds at this point. But there's nobody except for emergency vehicles and police personnel.
Can you see if there is a building that has been blown out by an explosion or where the explosion might have originated?
I'm standing a good 300 to 400 yards away. I can see the place where I believe the explosion was, but I cannot, from this distance, see any damage to anything. It's just too far with too many things in the way.
And so far, any official description of what happened or announcement of what they make of it?
I've heard 4 different rumors, all of which would be irresponsible to share with you because they weren't at all clarified. No official person has made any announcement, even if they have one. Given the chaos and large scale of a post-marathon area, I don't know how we'd hear it. There's no general P area. But no, I've been reading my Twitter feed and trying to see the news just like everybody else has to find out what happened 100 yards behind me.
And Peter, just before you go, once again, the time difference between the two explosions, how quick was that?
Basically, just remembering the moment, heard an explosion, turned around, second explosion.
That
so within
quickly.
Seconds, yeah.
Well, Peter Sagal, thank you very much. You're well, I hope. I mean, you didn't get injured.
I'm perfectly fine, and I'm very proud to say that I escorted a blind runner named William Greer to his first Boston Marathon finish. I'm very proud of that.
Hearing this again, I'm both pleased and ashamed that I took the opportunity of a live-breaking news hit to brag about my successful guiding. Why didn't I just say, "Hi, Mom"? I walked back to our meeting place to find that William had been reunited with Ellen, whose face was streaked with tears of relief. I reported in person to my companions what I had just reported to the nation via NPR, that I basically knew nothing. And there, still in an odd bubble of denial and ignorance, though now tinged with apprehension, we said our goodbyes. William and Ellen presented me with a special plaque they had made before the event to thank me for my guiding service. It felt odd to go through with a little ceremony they had planned for a more normal day. We embraced and went our separate ways to find home. The whole of Copley Square was blocked off. I walked around it to the west and saw a line of ambulances, dozens of them in a rank just outside the Fairmont Copley Plaza Hotel. They were obviously there for casualties, and judging by the number of ambulances, they expected a lot of them. News helicopters were swarming overhead. My uncle's house, where I was staying, was about 2 miles away, back along the course route on Commonwealth Avenue. But as I quickly found out, Commonwealth had been closed, running back for 5 miles or more. The police were worried that there were more bombs along the route, so 45 minutes after finishing a marathon, I had to walk a 4-mile peregrination through the fens. until I could get to a place far enough beyond the street closures for my uncle to pick me up. During that walk, I spoke to Jake Tapper of CNN and Jess Braven of The Wall Street Journal and turned down a chance to appear on Glenn Beck's network, The Blaze. Okay, I didn't just turn down The Blaze. I told the intermediary who passed on the invite to tell The Blaze that if I were the last potential guest on Earth and they the last network, that would be the end of the national broadcast media. Highlight of the afternoon, actually. I had to fly to Washington, D.C. that night to do an event for the PBS Constitution documentary the next day on Capitol Hill, and I was already so late getting back to my uncle's that I was in danger of missing my flight. I showered and rushed and made calls to the people who were waiting for me in D.C., so it was really only when I got to the airport, in plenty of time as it happened, that I could sit down to open my laptop and start streaming the news. I learned about Crystal Marie Campbell, Lou Lingsey, and Martin William Richard, all of whom had been killed, and the many others who lost limbs or suffered other terrible injuries. I learned that the bombings occurred at 2:49:43 EDT and 2:49:57 EDT, about 13 seconds apart, my guess to Robert Siegel was low, while the race clock, marking the elapsed time since the start of our wave, read 4:09. I looked at our finish time, still on my running watch, 4:04. I thought about that. I thought about that a lot, at the airport and on my flight, and in the taxi on the way to my hotel in D.C. Once there, I went to the hotel bar, ordered a martini, and read an email from my editor at Runner's World asking me to write about the day. I drank off about half the martini in a gulp and wrote down everything that happened, finishing with this. It only occurred to me, much later, as I viewed online videos of the bombing, how important William's gutsy last mile really was. We crossed the line at 4:04. The bomb went off as the clock read 4:09. 5 minutes later, which might well have been the 5 minutes that William would have needed to walk those last miserable blocks had he given in to the urgings of his hip, gut, and mind. But he ran the bravest and toughest mile of his life, not even able to see clearly what he was doing, just because he wanted to be able to say he did it. And by doing so, he crossed the line alive. I got an email from William the next day from his home in Austin. He wrote, "I have really sore legs. I'm ready to start training for the next marathon, and I'm going to have a lot more long runs. I had the speed, I just need to really increase my endurance. Thanks very much for being my sighted guide. You made the marathon a great pleasure. The only problems were the bombs." 5. My new townhouse looked, more than anything, like a very big hotel room. That is, it appeared as if no one had ever lived there before. All it needed was a minibar and a chocolate on the bedspread every night. It was big and mostly empty, furnished with the unwanted furniture from my former home, and those pieces that were unequivocally mine, like the armchair I won on Jeopardy in 1988, but felt even emptier. My friend Patty had told me that, as the daughter of divorce herself, the thing that most wounded her was that her father moved into a new home so small it didn't have a room for her. So I was determined to buy myself a large house with rooms for all three of my daughters. Then again, Patty was also my realtor. I didn't want a townhouse, at least not at first, but the houses that Patty showed me in my price range, it was not high, as I knew I'd still be paying for all my family's expenses, as well as all the legal bills for their foreseeable future, were weirdly too large. Seeing a place with bedrooms upstairs and living room and dining room downstairs, it was hard not to imagine myself as a smaller-scale Charles Foster Kane stumbling at night through empty rooms in my sad isolation. The townhouse, at least, with its vertical construction, meant that I could avoid wandering through the empty bedroom simply by ignoring the stairway rising to the next level. Each child would have her own bedroom on the top floor with its own bathroom, good for teenage girls. So now I was home. I was also hungry. I needed to cook something. But what? And how? And given my lifelong habit of stress eating, how much of it would I devour? Would this be the place where I finally lapsed into indolence or a second adolescence? Same thing. Eating dinners of corn chips and beer and frozen taquitos? Would I, a newly divorced dad, become the only worse thing I could think of? A fat divorced dad? If you've ever been fat, you will either be fat the rest of your life or you will worry about being fat the rest of your life. I came across those words in the manuscript of the play Fighting International Fat by Jonathan Reynolds. A pretty obscure place to find the underlying thesis of your waking life, but one doesn't get to specify where one would like it to show up. That casual observation struck me then and now with the profound power of its obvious truth, much like Kafka's observation, the meaning of life is that it ends. But of course, Kafka did not add that once you're dead, you won't gain weight, which is a comfort to me sometimes. I was, as mentioned earlier, a fat kid and terribly self-conscious about it, although some of the people who knew me as a child knit their brows in confusion when I tell them this. To them, I might have been a tad chubby, yet well within the bounds of normalcy. But from behind my eyes, I was a freak, slow and rubbery and comical, forced to shop in the husky section of the children's clothes store my mother took me to for semi-annual bouts of torture. At summer camp, I was known as Pumpkin, which became Plumpkin, which I accepted at the time as my due, but I felt so ashamed about it inside and thereafter that I kept it a secret from everyone, well, everyone who wasn't at Camp Beckett in the mid-1970s, for 40 years. Until now. Consider yourself honored. At the age of 15, I looked into the mirror and saw somebody I didn't like, so I started to run away from him. I used obsessive running as a way to make my fat self disappear as quickly as could be managed. I lost almost 40 pounds in that first manic bout of running, going from chubby to slender to skinny to thin, to my panicked mother bringing me to the doctor. He tested me and found me to be in good shape, if a bit bony. Running 7 miles a day will do that to you. And told me to be careful I didn't lose too much weight. I did not tell him that I had been restricting myself to less than 1,000 calories a day. I did not tell him how being so hungry all the time takes over your brain. When you're really hungry, as people who fast or are starving due to circumstance will tell you, all you can think about is food. It's why instead of eating, I would spend the lunch hour at school reading cookbooks in the library. It's why I would turn on the TV and wait through the tedious meal-less shows for the commercials, hoping they'd be for a restaurant or a packaged food. I yearned to see a film clip of a bowl of steaming Dinty Moore beef stew, like most adolescent boys at that time yearned to see a girly magazine. It's why I would lie in bed at night already tasting the lousy half grapefruit I allowed myself for breakfast. Dieting aficionados of a certain age will recognize the half grapefruit for breakfast as a tell for the Complete Scarsdale Medical Diet, published by Dr. Herman Tarnauer of Scarsdale, New York, which became quite the craze in the late 70s. Dr. Tarnauer, however, is now best remembered for getting himself murdered by a jealous girlfriend around the time I was on the diet in 1980. The late Dr. Tarnauer was played by Ben Kingsley in the Inevitable movie. For all that fasting and running and denying myself anything, and for all the pounds I shed, I would still take off my shirt at the beginning and end of every day. Sometimes I would sneak off to a bathroom with a locked door to do it at midday, and look at my protruding ribs and delineated hips and say to myself, still too fat. That breaks my heart to this day, that the fat kid had transformed himself into what he had always wanted to be, skinny, and he was too crazy to notice it. I am convinced that although it went undiagnosed at the time, I was struggling with a form of anorexia. Research shows there are very few teen boys who starve themselves and waste away to nothing, as anorectic girls do, and those who do tend to be extreme cases. Rather, some boys have the same urge as some girls to destroy themselves through the vehicle of the body, but they do it via extreme exercise. If a boy cuts his calorie count down to 800 per day to make weight for wrestling, or if he just obsessively runs long distances, he'll be celebrated for his devotion to bettering himself, even if he wants to better himself right into nothingness. We self-hating teen boys were just another kind of monastic order, down the street from the nunnery, and we chose a different way to flagellate ourselves. So, I dieted obsessively, and I ran a lot. I lost a lot of weight. Becoming a thin person after not being one for all of my life was disconcerting, partially because, as said before, I couldn't admit I was actually thin, and also because, surprise, my excess weight wasn't actually the problem. I was the same hot mess in a smaller bag. If I were the star of an 80s teen film, or more likely one of the odder supporting characters, I would have either finally won the big race and celebrated with a big meal, or found a girl willing to love me for who I was, and I'd sit down with her to share a sundae as the credits rolled. As it was, this period of my life simply ended, and then I went off to college. There, I couldn't starve myself because I was too busy. Girls, theater, new friends, classes, the challenge, shame, and thrill of finally knowing beyond any argument or stretch of the imagination or ego that I wasn't anywhere near the smartest person in the room. I was overwhelmed and delighted and distracted, and what did you know? The dining hall had unlimited refills. It's hard to deny yourself in one area when you're desperate to indulge in all the others. And so I gained the weight back and stopped running for a while, then started again, and ever since then have engaged in the weird war with the mirror, getting fat, getting skinny again, always examining my reflection for more clues as to what I was at any given moment. As I've related, my late-life running boom started the same way as my first 20 years before, when I found that there was a lot more of me than I wanted there to be. I started running again. I ran a race, and then I became determined to do a marathon, and I did, and then another, and I became a serious runner, and I lost 30 pounds along the way, and I'll be damned if I gain them back. Or should I say more damned? Because the obsession with weight, far more common among male amateur athletes than you might suppose, is a kind of curse. I run to eat, we say, and this is true, but we're not so much taking pleasure in the food as in the immunity our running gives us. We hit the box of donuts at work or the side of fries with lunch, saying to ourselves, I did my 6 this morning, and we feel for a fleeting moment that we are like everybody else, somebody who can indulge in sweets and fats without exposing ourselves as freaks. Being overweight in and of itself isn't the issue. I know people of all shapes, and I've learned that their sense of self isn't in any way determined by how much they weigh, although it is often the case that they are deeply affected by society's veneration of the thin and rejection of those who are not. It is, for some of us, simply the internalized horror of what we might become if we allow ourselves to get weak, to let go, to slow down. You should not run simply to lose weight, although if you do run, you probably will. There are a number of excellent reasons why you might not drop many pounds, one of which is that depending on how much you weigh now and your history and your biology, far beyond the simple chemical transactions we call metabolism, and your age, you may not even need to lose weight. Bodies are different, and research has shown that different people have different set points, a weight that you settle into as your point of equilibrium, even if it's 10 pounds more than a similar person of similar build and height. Another is that by becoming fit, you will build muscle, replacing one kind of weight with another. But most importantly, that way madness lies. To obsess about weight is to abject yourself before the god of the bathroom scale, to try to placate its obscure will, to take its praise as gospel and its disapproval as damnation. If you do, through some combination of circumstance or extraordinary self-discipline or madness, such as my high school bout of proto-anorexia, manage to lose weight below your set point, your body will let you know by possessing your brain in the manner of a demon of hunger. Everybody knows the feeling of their thoughts straying towards dinner as the day goes along. You start to get peckish about 4, and before you even realize you're hungry, you think that maybe tonight you'll stop at that good Chinese takeout place on the way home. Or remember that there are still some chicken thighs in the fridge you can fry up. Now, take that happy, anticipatory, peckish musing and give it methamphetamine. Just as I did during my hermitage in high school, you'll obsessively focus on your next meal, whatever it is you allow yourself. And once it arrives, you will gobble it up and end up licking the bowl like a starved dog, and then start thinking about whatever meal is next, and that will continue until you gain the weight back. And don't even get me started on the body mass index, BMI. Under that rubric, even at my fittest, when I can reel off 7-minute miles, one after another for 10 miles or more, I was still officially overweight. Your fitness is not reflected in your appearance. Watch a track and field competition. There will be an array of bodies, from the tiny, slender, long-distance runners to the broad-shouldered and heavy discus throwers. Each of them is a superb athlete, and very, very few of them will ever end up in the cover of Men's Fitness or Shape with their shirt and or pants off. Health has 1,000 ways of expressing itself, and the least important way is how much fat you can pinch between your fingers. Running has exploded in popularity in the last decade, and it's hard not to correlate the sport's growth with the obesity crisis. People feel fat. People are fat. People are terrified of getting fat. And then they see ridiculously fit people in spandex on the cover of Runner's World, leaping through the blank Pantone background like gods and goddesses descending from heaven saying, "Why not give this running thing a try?" If you read about the cover subjects and the note inside the magazine, you will discover that many of them aren't actually runners, but general-purpose fitness models gifted with genetics, youth, and the ability to spend hours every day in the gym and get paid for it. Real pro runners, the kind of people who become famous by simply being very good at running, are too skinny. Readers don't want to become a bony ectomorph with the gaunt, haunted look of a hunted elk. They want to become muscular, smooth, handsome, beautiful, with perfect skin and not a single hair, perhaps blown off by the rushing wind as they lope through the California sun. You can run to Zanzibar and never find that person looking back at you from a mirror. Recently, though, the magazine has been featuring real runners on their cover, although strangely, not me. Yet. That said, physics applies to runners as well. To move a certain mass, you need a certain amount of energy. Most runners lose weight not simply because of the increased caloric expenditure, but because the body has a natural ability to adapt to whatever its purpose becomes. People who lift heavy things become bigger, thicker, more stable. People who move quickly and constantly become smaller, lighter, sharper, with less excess to drag along. The elite runners I've met look narrow and sharp, carved out of flat planes that cut through the air like a stealth bomber. That probably will never happen to you, just as it never happened to me. Even when I was in my top running shape, I was still short and squat, and I will die with the love handles I was born with. What can happen, though, is a transformation of your body, not just a loss of fat and gain of muscle, but a metamorphosis of body and mind. If you can pass through that difficult initial period and become somebody who runs 4 or 5 times a week, you can increase your average daily caloric expenditure by a third or more. If you manage not to give in to the common urge to reward yourself by your run with an extra cupcake, the weight will come off naturally, and over time, your set point, your body's own equilibrium, will start to change. If you keep it up, running will help you become not the person you see on the magazine covers, but yourself, or at least a version of you closer to what evolution designed you to be. Chances are you were not designed to be a fitness model, but evolution certainly didn't mean for you to sit on a couch. You were designed over millions of years to chase your food across the veldt, or at least to flee from something trying to do the same to you. And by returning to that initial purpose, you can restore your own primordial form. Our pre-modern ancestors were in excellent shape, Fred Flintstone notwithstanding. One thing that will help, of course, is diet. And that, too, is something your running will affect, and something that will affect your running. By diet, I mean what you actually eat, not what some magazine or author or murdered doctor or celebrity or wife of Jerry Seinfeld recommends you should eat. That kind of diet doesn't work and never has and never will. The secret of every single diet is calorie restriction imposed by various kinds of gimmicks, be it all carbs or all fats or all things we assume our ancient ancestors would have eaten in their healthy, natural lifestyles, right up until the moment they themselves were eaten by a bear at the age of 30. The reason my lunchtime sojourns to the library worked, if making me skinny yet miserable can be called working, is that, like all diets ever invented, they restricted my calories. If you consume fewer calories than you expend, like, say, via obsessive running, you will lose weight as the body makes up the difference by breaking down stored fat. Here, I just invented the second file cabinet diet, in which you eat only food starting with the letters M through Z. Marshmallows, but no apples. Try it, and you'll lose weight, for a while, until you go mad and gorge yourself on figs. In 2010, Professor Mark Haub of Kansas State University decided to prove this point by putting himself on a diet of only Twinkies and other processed snack foods. His intent was to see if only restricting calories, in his case down to 1,800 calories a day, was sufficient to lose weight without any regard for the kinds of foods those calories came in. His results were impressive and would be the kind of thing that could have made him into a diet guru were he a minor celebrity. He lost 27 pounds in 2 months with no negative effects on his health at all. Unfortunately for his future career as the Twinkie diet millionaire, he's a scientist, so he was actually kind of glum about his findings. I wish I could say it's healthy, he said. I'm not confident enough in doing that. So, what is a weight-obsessed runner to do in order to lose weight and keep it off, if not diet? It's simple. Make sure as much of your diet as possible is clean food, non-processed and raw when you buy it. Buy what you need when you need it, the way Europeans do. so your food won't sit long enough in your house to need preservatives or stabilizers. Avoid things with colorful packaging and lists of ingredients in tiny type, especially if they're words you can't pronounce. Carbs are fine, as long as they come in the form of vegetables and fruits and natural starches. Protein is fine, as long as it comes in beans, legumes, and leaner, non-processed meats. Even fat is fine, as long as it comes in natural oils and in the fruits and meats that contain them. Food is processed so as to maximize the things we like about food, sugars, fats, and eliminate things like bitter flavors and fiber, which normally serve to keep us from eating too much. We have evolved over millions of years to be natural omnivores, but it will take another million to adapt to eating Cheetos. And of course, if you can, cook your own food. And everybody can. Most of the things people tend to buy pre-made, be they hamburger patties or pancake mix, are ridiculously easy to prepare yourself and taste much better when you do. A hamburger? Buy fresh ground beef, sprinkle with salt and pepper, shape it loosely into a patty, and fry it in its own fat in a hot cast iron pan. Pancake? Flour, salt, baking powder, sugar, milk, eggs, butter. The food you make at home will generally be fresher, less processed, and thus less caloric than what you buy pre-made at a store or in a restaurant. Plus, if you bake your own bread, you'll know for a fact you didn't slip in any high fructose corn syrup, unless you have a split personality and your other self is trying to kill you. One of the great mental obstacles to home cooking is current food culture, which revolves around TV shows depicting tense proto-geniuses trying to whip alchemical cuisine out of things like old rutabagas and shredded tires. They apply sous vide cookers and pastry bags and nitrogen injectors to create foams and curls and reclaimed reductions. So we begin to think of cooking as something impossibly complicated, something best watched rather than attempted. As writer Michael Pollan noted in 2009, the rise of cooking shows, or more aptly, food shows, coincided with the decline of home cooking. But if you think of the things you actually like to eat rather than watch being prepared, be it a burger or a vegetarian chili or a grilled cheese sandwich, they are all simple. And as such, they are not guilty pleasures. They are merely pleasures and easily recreated at will. During most of my deceased marriage, my wife had stayed home to take care of the children and thus had done almost all of the cooking. She had been raised by a mother and aunts who had learned to cook from their mothers and aunts. And she knew all those alchemical tricks, like how to make a white sauce or how to cut onions so that they flavored a dish rather than interrupted it with rubbery chunks, as when I cooked with them. She proudly never followed a recipe exactly, always adding or subtracting something. And while it's hard to say whether her results were better than the exact recipe might have been, they were always good. She was showing off, and justifiably so. As for me, I was in charge of the dad foods. I did all the grilling and specialized in anything that required cool equipment, like the electric crepe maker. But my approach to cooking was algorithmic. A recipe, or the instructions on the electric crepe maker, was a series of steps to be followed, and if the result didn't come out well, it was probably because I didn't follow the steps correctly. When making food for the kids, I didn't dare second-guess the instructions as their mother could. I didn't know how to do anything but follow directions. If there were no directions, I was at a loss, which, come to think of it, might be part of the reason I ended up alone in this townhouse. But even if I had taken an unexpected off-ramp into divorce land, I didn't have to do everything this particular script required. I wasn't going to become one of those divorced men whose refrigerators were filled with nothing but half-empty takeout containers with a pile of soy sauce packets in the butter compartment. I was going to learn to cook from scratch, raw ingredients to be used by a raw cook. In the years since those first nights, I've learned to make decent home-cooked food. I did it through practice and tasting what I was cooking while I was cooking it, and using recipes not just as instructions, but as lessons. If a recipe told me to add something, I tried to figure out why. When I could, I'd taste something before adding an additional ingredient, and then after to see what improvement it had made. I can now make a good white sauce of my own, and a wine reduction, and I can finally do wonders with an onion and a sharp knife. But mostly, I learned this. The secret to eating well is simply to eat well, meaning ingredients you can identify, prepared in a way replicable by you in your own kitchen. The secret to not eating too much is to stop eating when you're not hungry anymore. The secret of a good diet is to cook, And the secret of cooking is to care about the food you're making, about the ingredients you're using, and mostly about the person you're cooking for, especially if that person is yourself. Back in high school, I waged war on my own body and my own desires, and to hate your desires is to hate yourself. These days, me and I get along much better. Sure, I could stand to lose a little weight, but I'm healthy for my age. I can still reel off a fast 10 miles if I need to.